February 27th, 1962, Lecture 32. February 27th, 1962, Lecture 32. February 27th, 1962, Lecture 32. February, you're set. February 27th, 1962, Lecture 32, The Origin of Refractive Index. February 27th, 1962, Lecture 32, The Origin of Refractive Index. February 27th, 1962, Lecture 32, The Origin of Refractive Index.
Okay. Today's lecture is on the theory of the origin of the index of refraction. But before I begin the subject itself, I need a formula which properly belongs to the previous lecture and which I didn't have time to derive there, which we will need for this present lecture. So I'll explain what I want. In the theory of diffraction that we talked about before, we talked about the intensity of light from different arrangements of sources at infinity. And but one problem I want to solve that's easily solved is this. Suppose that you had a whole plane all full of sources, all oscillating together and in phase. What is the field at a finite distance but very large distance away? We can't get very close because we don't have the right formulas inside the wave zone, of course, but we say several waves lengths away. We need the field here produced by oscillators in a plane. And then suppose that there are n charges per unit area. That is, the place is just covered with these charges all over, and they're all oscillating together. Each one has a charge q, and every one of them moves together in the same pattern with a certain amplitude x naught cosine omega t. I use the complex notation, so you read the real part to get the actual motion. The problem is to find the field at a distance z from the plane. Now, to find the field here from all of the charges, I can do it by finding the field from one of the charges and then integrating over all of the contributions from all of the charges, because the field is the sum of the contributions from each charge. A particular charge has a certain acceleration, which is obtained by differentiating this twice, and we know that's minus omega squared x naught. But the acceleration that we need at the point P is not the acceleration at the charge Q, but that acceleration retarded in time, so that the acceleration is not at P is that we need to calculate the field. There's the acceleration at the earlier time, T minus R over C, where this is the distance R. Therefore, the field at P from the single charge at Q is this. You remember the got a minus sign somewhere. It's minus the charge over 4 pi epsilon naught c squared times the acceleration retarded and divided by the radius. Also multiplied by the sine of the projection angle. But we suppose that z is so far apart and that the rho that I need to integrate over is relatively small that I'm going to disregard those effects of the angles. They're nearly one. So then this is the field produced by one charge, which is a charge times the acceleration retarded divided by the distance. And the total field produced at P then, since they all produce the field in essentially the same direction within our approximation, is an integral of this, the contribution of one charge multiplied by the number of charges which exist in the between the radius rho and rho plus d rho, which is the area of a circle, which is 2 pi rho d rho, times the number of charges per square centimeter, which is n. This r is just the r that belongs under here. Now, in order to calculate this thing, I need to do a certain integral, and I take all the constants away for a minute and look at the integral. You see, everything else is constant, so the integral that I need is the integral from 0 to infinity of e to the I omega t minus r over c times 2 pi's and so on, rho d rho over r, rho d rho over r, from 0 rho to infinity. But R square is equal to rho square plus z square, and z is constant. And if I differentiate this, I get is 2r dr equal 2 rho d rho. So rho d rho is r dr. How fortunate, because that cancels this r, and I just have dr. So this complicated-looking thing is just dr. And an exponential, to integrate an exponential is very easy. You divide by the coefficient, you see, and then have the exponential at the limits. But the limits of r are not the same as the limits of rho. The limits of rho are 0 to infinity. The limits of r are z, the smallest, to infinity. So first I put z in for r, and then I put infinity in for r. And e to the I infinity is a mysterious quantity. Say the real part of it is cosine infinity. Well, you can't tell if it's plus or minus 1. In most physical problems, I mean, mathematically speaking, this is a completely indefinite proposition and doesn't mean anything. But in the physical circumstance, it does mean something definite, and it usually means that this should be put equal to 0. In our particular case, the reason is the following. What we're doing is we're integrating little exponentials, which we can represent by summing vectors as before, which is represented by going around in a circle. And now if we go to a finite z anywhere and stop, we get an answer, which is this length. If you go to another z, you get a different answer. So the answer is oscillating and is never finished. However, in actual fact, first there's a decrease in the intensity because of these angles. But more important, there's other phenomena. For instance, the intensity of the light may not be absolutely constant throughout the entire plane. So it may weaken as you get far and further and further away. Things don't go to infinity. Or it's a hole in the screen. And although we start our integration here, as we go to bigger and bigger circles, and pretty soon we don't get the full steam, but the intensity begins to go down. And so what we want in this problem is a case in which gradually, as the thing goes around, the intensity goes down. And that corresponds to wanting this vector. And if you figure that out, it corresponds to putting this equals 0. Well, if I use this value of the integral here in here, and I write the answer over again by combining the 2 pi with the 4 pi and so on, I get this result. And that's what I was looking for. I seem to have a sign mixed up somewhere. It's a very important matter, which I'll have to think about. Why is it by minus I? Because I put the lower limit in first. So that was right. So if I divide I minus and minus, well, let's take what it gives us, minus. Oh, and then this would be plus. No, then this would be minus. That's right. That's right. Good. It's all right. This is minus. It's correct. I hope. Now, incidentally, it's rather interesting if you'll notice that the velocity of this charge is x I omega x naught e to the I omega t, so that this combination here is simply the velocity of the charge at this point delayed by the distance z, a rather curious, simple result. But anyway, that's the result we need. The thing to remember is not so much the formula, but the idea is nothing to how to, you just have to integrate the charges, the contribution of all the different sources. Well, that's all I need. That's what I need for this lecture. And now I must start the lecture on the theory of the index of refraction. We have said before that light goes slower in water than in air, and slower, slightly, in air than in vacuum. And this is described by an index of refraction, n. Now, we have to study this in order to explain how it comes about. The reason we have to study it to explain how it comes about is that we made some physical assumptions or some statements earlier, which was the following, that the total electric field in any physical circumstance can always be represented by the sum of the fields from all moving charges, sum over all charges, of the field generator by each. Every moving charge, you have to add all the fields together. We also said that the field from a single charge was given in some kind of a thing with a retardation at the speed c. Always. But you see, in a piece of glass, you'd say, no, you should modify all this. You should say it's retarded at the speed c over n. That's not right. I mean, we have to understand that now. That's right in this net result. But we have to see how, with these two principles, where there's only the speed c, there's an effective change in the apparent velocity through materials. That's the puzzle. Now, we could, at first, in fact, it was simply stated that the equations are different in the matter than they are in a vacuum, and that there's some kind of change that should be for a different speed. But this is not a satisfactory interpretation, ultimately, because the next problem comes as to how much should the speed be in different substances, what controls the velocity under different circumstances, and so forth. So it's part of physics to analyze that, too. And so a deeper understanding is to take a more fundamental point of view, and that's what we're going to do today. We're going to stick to this and see where the index comes from. And the answer is the following. If we have a piece, say, of glass here, and we have a source here, which I'll call the outside source or the external source, that's a light bulb, and we ask for the field somewhere, say, behind the glass or anywhere, or in the glass, the field in the glass or any other place is equal to the field produced by the external source, that's E sub s, that you would obtain by retardation at the speed c, plus the sum of all fields from all other moving charges. That's our principle. This is retarded. This is the field as if there were no glass. But this is a correction. And so the actual field is not the field that you would get as if there's no glass, but there's a correction from all the other charges which are moving. What other charges which are moving? Ha. The theory is that the glass contains atoms which contain electrons, and when the electric field of the source acts on these atoms, it drives the electrons up and down because of the force on the electron. Now, moving electrons generate a field. They constitute a source. And so you see that the other moving charges are originally driven from the source, and so they do move, and this is connected somehow to the field of the source, that the total field is not just the field of the source, but it's modified by the additional contributions from the other moving charges. This then means that the field inside the glass is not the same as one which is propagating at the speed c, but is modified, and as a matter of fact, it turns out, is modified in such a way that the field inside the glass appears to be moving at a different velocity. And that's the idea, that the field inside the glass is not the one that moves at the speed c, but when you add all this together, it moves at the velocity different than the speed c, apparently. The total field does. Now, this is, in fact, pretty complicated, because although I said that all the other moving charges are driven by the source field, that isn't quite true. Because if we take a particular charge here, it doesn't just feel the source. But like anything else in the world, it feels all the charges that are moving. In fact, it feels charges that are moving somewhere else in the glass. So that the total field which is acting on this itself is a combination of the fields from the other charges, and so on. So it's a big, complicated, self-consistent analysis that has to be done to get the complete formula. This is so complicated that we reserve this for next year. But instead, we take the case, a simplified case that understands all the physical principles very clearly, which is this. We take a circumstance in which the effects from the other atoms is very small relative to the effect from the source. In other words, we take a material in which this field is not modified very much by these. That corresponds to a material in which the index is very close to 1, and the density of the atoms are very low. In other words, we'll calculate the index of refraction of a gas, say, a low-density material, or a material in which the index is, for any reason, very close to 1. That's to avoid the complications of the mutual consistency of the solution. Incidentally, in addition to these atoms generating a field which combines with this to make a field going this way at the speed c, these atoms in motion also generate naturally fields in this direction that propagate out that way, and that's reflected light from the surface of the medium, we say. But it doesn't just reflect from the surface. As a matter of fact, it's stuff that comes from the interior. So that a surface of glass or water reflects light. But this is beyond our approximation at the moment because we have to calculate with an index so close to one that very little is reflected. Before I do that, though, I would like to just remind you that all we have to do is explain that the propagation of light in this medium appears to be at a different velocity to understand refraction. Because, as you're probably familiar, if we had a wave that came at an angle to the light, and the wavelength in the vacuum was lambda, say lambda zero, then if at the same frequency, the oscillations, of course, of the atoms inside are at the same frequency, if the wave travels slower in the medium, then the distance it can go in one oscillation is less, and the wavelength in the medium is equal to the wavelength outside divided by the index of refraction. So the wavelength in the medium is less. So that means that the wave fronts, as they come along, move slower in the medium. And so, as you see, the thing has to fit together this way. Well, if you fish around with the angles, you'll find that the ratio of this sine of this angle to the sine of that angle is, in fact, n in order for them to fit together. So that's the way that the index works on refraction. But our central problem, therefore, is not to talk about the bending, but to explain why the wavelength inside the material is different than it is outside. Now, to do this, then, we must do two things. We must first figure out, for a thin layer of gas, assuming that the gas has an index, suppose that the gas is has a thickness delta Z only, and has an index n. Supposing that the gas has a certain index, we have to figure out how much the wave back here from a source over here will be altered. In other words, we have to figure the total field as the source field plus a correction, which I'll call E sub A, the field from the atoms in the gas. Incidentally, this thing is going to end up to be so complicated that I've written all the letters that I'm going to use on the board here. In case you forget while I'm talking what one of the letters are, you can quickly glance up there and find out what it is. It's complicated in this respect that there are many pieces that have to be put together. But each piece is very simple. Now, this is probably the most complicated thing that we're going to do this year, but it's complicated only in what's being put together. Unlike other derivations where I say forget the derivation, just look at the answer. In this case, we don't need the answer so much as the derivation. In other words, the thing to really understand is the physical machinery for the production of the index. And then you can watch me actually use the physical machinery idea to actually calculate the index, which is what I'm going to do now. If light moves in a material with an index n, then the light wave would be represented by some strength, E0, say, times cosine of omega t minus z over c. But no, in the material, because it has an index, we would expect the wave to look like this. So inside a material, we expect to represent a wave like this if we have an index. Then, of course, I would rather use the complex variables because it's easier to calculate everything. So I have here nz over c. Now, it's interesting to notice that this wave inside the material can be also written equally well as e to the minus I omega times n minus 1 over e I omega over c times n minus 1 z times e to the I omega t minus z over c. This can be understood this way. This, if this weren't here, would be just the propagation at the speed c. But as it goes along, the amplitude of the wave is changing all the time. Of course, this is a complex number, and it means, since it's e to the I something, that the phase of the wave is changing all the time. That means that relative to what it would be in a vacuum, the phase of the wave is advancing, or retarding, actually, is getting behind all the time. That's perfectly sensible. If it takes longer for the wave to go through the material, then, of course, at a certain point, the phase will have been delayed by the extra time. And the extra time, because it's in a medium rather than in a vacuum, is given by this difference here. So what we have to explain is a continuously advancing phase change, and in order to do it, I'm only going to take a very thin layer delta z. All I have to explain is that in the thin layer delta z, the phase has changed by this much. In other words, the field way out here, I claim, in this particular problem, the field at the point P, say, total field, will be equal to the field that was incident times e to the minus I omega over c times n minus 1 delta z times e to the I omega t minus z over c if this distance down from here to here is z, and I take this to be z equals 0 at this point. The reason is the following. This is the field inside the material. At this point, at delta z, the field is this thing times delta z, and this at delta z. But I have an additional retardation to get to here of z minus delta z, so that afterwards, when it's in the vacuum again, it keeps on going, and so this changes to z. Or put it still more simply this way. The light in going through here, where there's an index n, is delayed in time. How long? The time it takes to go through is n delta z over the speed c. Delayed relative to what it would have been if there were no material there is this. The time it would take if there were no material is delta z over c. Therefore, this is the total delay in time. Now, if we want the delay in phase, then we have to multiply by the phase change per second. That's the frequency. So we have n delta z over c minus delta z over c times omega. This is the delay in phase. And so the light that comes out is the light that would have been there if you didn't know about the material, delayed in phase by an amount omega minus omega over c n minus 1 delta z. In other words, then, this is, but now finally I would like to write this in this way. First, I suppose that delta z and n minus 1, in particular n minus 1 delta z, is so small that the exponential can be written as 1 plus its exponent. I don't have just the room where I want it. Well, how to get it in. Okay, it's the sum of two terms. It's e0, e to the I omega t minus z over c. See, I'm writing this thing as 1 minus its thing, 1 minus the amplitude. The 1 gives me this, and the minus the amplitude gives me this. Minus I omega over c n minus 1 delta z times e naught e to the I omega t minus z over c. That's accurate enough for us. Let me draw some pictures of what's going on. The field that would have been there if there were no material is, say, that. But this material generates an additional field here, which, because of the I, is 90 degrees out of phase. And so the new field is slightly different. This is the field behind the layer. Now, if there were several layers in a row in succession, then this field would be the one that would enter the next layer, and it would produce another shift. And so the next layer would look like this, and the next layer would look like this, and so on. And so you see the phase would, as you went through thicker and thicker layers of gas, would gradually, perpetually revolve. And this would be what this formula says. But we only need to analyze the thinnest piece in order to find the formula for it. Therefore, the problem is this, then, if we have to understand it this way. This term, the energy from the source, the field from the source, is evidently this one. And so if we could figure out how much field we would expect from the atoms and equate it with this, then we'll have a formula for the index. This term here must be the field produced by the atoms. And so I now turn my attention to the problem of calculating the field produced by the atom. And then I'm going to put that equal to this, and I'll have a formula then for the index. Okay? Now we have to find the field produced by the atom. Oh, well, we have it all here. That's what I did this for. This is the field that will be produced by a large number of oscillators in a sheet that's very thin, all oscillating up and down, and that's just what we have. Do we? Well, suppose that we have a external field coming this way from the source, which would be E0 e to the I omega t minus z over c. Or at this point where the atoms are, the field is E0 e to the I omega t effectively because z is 0. Each of these atoms then feels this field, and the electron in the atom is driven up and down in some motion. If we knew the motion, when we're all finished having the motion, we just have to get the field that's generated. We just have to use this formula. So we now need to find the motion of all the atoms. We'll suppose that the electrons in the atom can be considered as harmonic oscillators. This is a very funny model of the atom. You usually hear about orbits and all this kind of stuff. This is because we're trying to use classical mechanics when only quantum mechanics is valid. And the quantum mechanics demonstrates that for this application, the atom behaves as if the electron were on a spring, that if you pulled it out and let go, it would oscillate. And so we'll suppose that the electrons obey a kind of Hooke's law. If you pull them away from their equilibrium position in the atom, there's a restoring force, and they have a mass m, so that the equation of motion of the electrons, where x is the vertical displacement of them, will be written this way, where omega naught is the natural frequency of the electron. This equals the force which is acting on the electrons, which in this particular problem is the charge on the electron, in fact, multiplied by the field, which is, as already noted, e to the I omega t. So you see, we're beginning at last to put pieces together of the things that we learned before. From this, we can immediately deduce that x is equal to x0 e to the I omega t, where x0 is equal, if you substitute this expression in here, and so forth, you get the formula which we worked out long ago, which is this. 1 over m times omega squared minus omega naught squared minus omega squared, times the charge on the electron times E0 e to the I omega t. Well, not x0 doesn't have the e to the I omega t in it. So, okay, so x has it. x0 e to the I omega t, which is x, is equal to this. Oscillating, following the field with a phase shift one way or the other, depending on the sign of the. In other words, how far have we got? We got an external field driving the electrons. We've now found out how they move. Now, knowing how they move, we have to calculate what the field is that's produced back here by them all moving. The atomic field EA. And to do that, I look over here a formula which I've derived before. This is the field produced by a number of oscillating objects, and I only have to copy this down. So I start to copy it down, and I get the following, minus N. Well, the number of atoms per square centimeter here is the number of electrons per cubic centimeter, multiplied by the thickness delta z. That will give me the number of atoms per square centimeter. This, in other words, is n in the formula. Next comes q over 2 epsilon naught. Well, the q in this case is q of the electron. Next comes I omega x naught e to the I omega t minus z and so forth. Here's the formula for x naught, if you can forget about these exponentials. So right away, I'll put I omega times x naught. X naught is 1 over m times omega naught square minus omega square times q sub electron e naught. And then it says times e to the I omega t minus z over c. That then is an exact copy of this equation here for the field produced by a number of atoms. And although after I got it down, you can't find the pieces, I will remind you that this piece, this is a complicated piece here, this is x naught. And then it's an obvious substitution from here. See, what I say is complicated is only that there are so many parts, not the idea isn't very complicated. The idea is the field makes these move in accordance with the response of an oscillator. The moving charges generate a field, and we put them together. Oh, the result is very complicated looking, but the idea is simple enough. So it's more important to remember the idea than the derivation. Now look, this tells us that the field back here has a form e to the I omega t z minus c, which is just the form that we need if this thing is going to have an index of refraction, that the field that's back there is proportional to delta Z, the thickness. That's good. And so by dividing out the necessary factors, I'm making this equal this. I don't want to have to write it because it's such a long expression. I want you to know that what I'm doing is I'm saying this equals this in order to find the formula for the index. And when I put this equals this, oh, I forgot another important point. The field is also proportional to the external field, E naught, which is necessary for this to work, which is right. So when I put this, you see there are a large number of factors which are common. Even the I omega is common. And the C and so forth. So when I'm all finished, I get the following formula for the index. N minus 1 is equal to minus times minus is plus. Yeah, that's okay then. N minus 1 is equal to Q sub electron squared over 2 epsilon naught multiplied by, or M times 1 over omega naught squared minus omega squared times the number of atoms per cc. And that's what we were trying to get to. But the main point is, of course, the way we got there. The main idea is that we did this. We found the field that was generated by a layer of gas directly from the motions of the atoms in the gas. We also noticed that such a field generated would have the same effect as a shift of phase of the light by this addition of vectors. And we found, in fact, what index corresponds to what amount of excess field. And then by checking one against the other, we found how much index is generated by the gas. We have discovered the index of refraction of a gas, provided, of course, that we know for this gas how many electrons there are per cubic centimeter. This should be really electrons here. And what the natural frequency omega naught of the gas is. Of course, we don't know that. It's different for every different gas. We can't get a general theory of that now. The general theory of the properties of different substances, their natural frequencies, and so on, is only possible in the quantum mechanics. But different gases have different properties, and they have different indices. So we can't expect to get a general formula for the index of any gas. However, I'd like to discuss the formula under different circumstances. First of all, for all most ordinary gases, for instance, for air, most colorless gases, hydrogen, air, and so on, the natural frequencies of the oscillators are in the ultraviolet. That is higher than light. Omega zero is much larger than omega square. And to the first approximation, you can disregard this compared to that. And then you find that the index is nearly constant. So for gas first, the index is nearly constant. And that's also true for most transparent substances beside the gas. However, to look at it a little bit more closely, we notice that as omega rises, taking a little bit away from the denominator, the index rises. So if omega zero is greater than omega, n rises slowly with frequency. That is, the index is higher at the blue end than at the red end, and that's the reason why a prism deflects the light more in the blue than in the red, because the index is different at different frequencies. Incidentally, the phenomenon that the index depends upon the frequency is called the phenomenon of dispersion, because it's the basis, of course, in which a light is dispersed by a prism into a spectrum. And in fact, an equation for the index of refraction as a function of frequency is called a dispersion equation. So we have a dispersion equation. And that's perfectly all right. Now comes an interesting circumstance. If we have a natural frequency, say, in the visible region, or if you measure the index of refraction in the ultraviolet, where omega gets near omega zero, you see that very close to the natural frequency, the index gets enormously large. So when omega is near omega zero, the index is very high. But that has to be very close in order to get to be very high. Next. Suppose an omega is greater than omega zero. For example, if we take a light material like aluminum, or say carbon even better, for carbon, and use x-rays, all the natural frequencies of the carbon, let's say one angstrom x-rays, all the natural frequencies of the carbon are much lower than the natural frequency, than the frequency that we're using in the X-ray. Or take another example, the example of free electrons. In the upper atmosphere, electrons are liberated as free electrons by ultraviolet rays, and they sit up there as free electrons. For free electrons, omega zero is zero. There's no stiffness constant. And this formula for the index, this is the correct formula for the index refraction for radio waves in the stratosphere, where capital N is the density of electrons per cc in the stratosphere, free electrons in the stratosphere. And for X-rays, the same formula works. But look what a horrible thing. The N minus 1 is negative. That means N is less than 1. That means the speed of light is faster in the material than in the vacuum, not slower. And that's correct. In spite of the fact that it's said that you cannot send signals any faster than the speed of the light, it is nevertheless true that the index of refraction of materials as a function of frequency can be either a greater or less than 1. The phase shift, which is produced by the scattered light, can either be this way or that way, and that the set of vectors as you go through the material can either rotate one way or the other. It can be shown, however, that the speed at which you send the signal is not the index. What the index is the speed at which the nodes of the wave travel. And the node of a wave is not a signal by itself. In a perfectly perfect wave, which has no modulations of any kind, a steady oscillation, you couldn't tell what the speed is. In order to send the signal, you've got to change the wave somehow to make a notch in it, make it get a little bit fatter or a little bit thinner. And that means you have to have more than one frequency in the wave. And it can be shown that the speed at which signals travel is not dependent upon the index alone, but on the way that the index changes with frequency. The derivative of the index with respect, say, to wavelength or frequency in addition to the index. This subject we have also to delay until next term. And then I'll calculate for you the actual speed of a signal through such a piece of glass. But let me guarantee you that it will not be faster than the speed of light, although the nodes, which are mathematical points, do travel faster than the speed of light. Just to give a slight hint as to how that happens, you'll note that the real difficulty has to do with the fact that the responses of the charges are opposite the field, that the sign has gotten reversed, that it's not like a spring where the charge pulls. If this is the important term, when the electric field pulls, then the thing follows. But if this is the important thing, when the electric field pulls, the thing goes opposite. And how does it get to go opposite? When you first apply the force, why does it go opposite? How absurd. If you were suddenly turn on an oscillating force, it's not right that the charge starts to move opposite. It moves in a direction. It accelerates in a direction of the field. But after a while, it has this transient business, which then settles down to an oscillation which is opposite. And so it is with this. If I were to study the transients of light going through the material, if I were to suddenly turn on a light, if this is the input signal, zero, and then oscillations, I meant to have them all at the same wavelength in spite of my drawing, then the response that comes out of the other end of the, well, let's say that's the field that went in. Then the response that comes out is something like this. There's nothing before the signal, and then it goes along and it wiggles and it's very complicated, and then it ends up, I got it ending up a little bit wrong. It ends up like this. Excuse me. It ends up as though it were ahead of the original wave. If you want to, it's behind by more than one cycle. Anyhow, it never gets out before it goes in, but this subject will have to delay till later. It doesn't go any faster than the source signals will go any faster than the speed of light. Now I would like to remark on a more realistic analysis, how it would be changed. In the first place, in a real gas, it turns out that it is not, the model is not satisfactory, because at resonance you get infinity. And as we know, the oscillators may be represented as damped oscillators. So the first thing that the formula, in the first way, respect that the formula is changed, is this. If omega I, instead of omega zero, I'll show you why in a minute, is called the natural frequency of the oscillator, then if gamma I is a damping, then the formula looks like that instead of the other one. We've worked that out too. In addition, it turns out that unreal gas consists of more than one oscillator. That is, it isn't got just one natural frequency, but a number of natural frequencies. And if, let's say, Ni is the effective number of electrons corresponding to natural frequency omega I, then the formula is modified to the following. Sum over all of the different natural frequencies by the proportion of the electrons, and with each one damped, and this is a more complicated but equally understandable formula. The index under these circumstances looks like this. If this is n minus 1, or this is n and this is 1 here, then the thing looks like this. As we approach one of these resonances, it goes way up, swings way down, and comes back over here. And then, again, at another one, it goes up again at another place and does this again. Incidentally, here, the index is increasing with frequency. And that is they get a piece of glass or gas works, and it was the first kind of form of index varying with frequency that was noticed by people. So it's called normal dispersion. Here, for a very quick motion, the index is falling with increasing frequency, and this, when it was first discovered, was so surprising, it was called anomalous dispersion. But it's all part of the theory of dispersion. However, now you're terrified by noticing that the formula I've written for n gives a complex number to n. That's bad enough that it was less than 1 before. Now it's even complex. And what does the imaginary part mean? If you look quickly here, you'll see that the index can be written as one piece. Both n prime and n are going to be real, n prime and n double prime. So I can write n, a complex number, this way. And you'll notice also from the way the signs are here that this must be negative, this n double prime. Now, if you will put, for n minus 1 in here, a real part and an imaginary part, if part of this n has a minus I n double prime in it, what happens to that part? Well, I times I is minus 1 and minus minus is plus, so that piece will become the following. That part of it, and you can figure out the rest of it, is n omega double prime over c z, real. That means that this amplitude of the wave is not only changing its phase, but also its size. As the wave goes through the material, it gets weaker and weaker. This is an absorbing material. So as soon as we put on damping, we have absorption. And the imaginary part of the index represents the absorption of the light. So the coefficient of absorption of the material, which would be the imaginary part of the index, is the imaginary part of this thing, and it looked like this. Nothing, 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 but as you remember always how these resonance lines look, all the absorption is very close to the natural frequency. So we have absorptions. So as we vary the frequency, we find that there are certain frequencies that the gas does not transmit in a very narrow band. So the atmosphere of the sun, for example, has dark lines when you make the spectrum, because the light which is coming from below, which has all frequencies in it, is absorbed very strongly whenever the frequency is the natural frequency of one of the atoms. And so from the position and frequency of the dark lines or spectral line, we can determine the natural frequencies of the atoms, and checking those against the ones in the laboratory, we have discovered that there is nothing on the sun that is not on the Earth. All the substances are the same. With regard to this absorption, I would like to discuss whether or not, oh, first, of course, the way it works with our little diagrams is that now, instead of being directly perpendicular, the scattered wave has a little in component, so the new wave is a little weaker, and each time as it goes through thicker and thicker layers, it will get weaker and weaker. Now, as the light gets weaker, of course, you say, well, that's easy to understand. Work is done on the atoms by the external source. Heat is generated in the layer of gas by the light, and the light intensity must therefore go down because it's absorbed. Our understanding of absorption, however, is an interference, and it's interesting to see how it works. So I'm going now to check whether or not the energy that's taken out of the light beam can be accounted for by the work done on the atoms. And in fact, we're going to use that fact that it can be accounted for to determine the formula for the energy carried by a wave. We've already given an argument that the energy carried by a wave per square centimeter per second, I forgot to write per unit area here, per second, is proportional to the average, that's what that means, because the field is oscillating, I mean average in time, of the square of the magnitude of the electric field. Suppose then that we had a layer, like the layer over here, with an external field E0 acting on it. Then this field, this layer of moving atoms, would generate a field EA here and in here. I will calculate only to the first order in the density of atoms. It turns out it checks, of course, the conservation of energy checks to all orders, but we only need to calculate to the first order. Now I argue that the energy in must be the energy out plus the work done on the atoms. I don't know what the constant of proportionality is going to be. I only know it's proportional. We will determine the constant of proportionality. The energy out will be the outcoming field, which is the total field, E naught plus EA squared, averaged. And the work done on the atoms is what? Well, first of all, per unit area, it's the number of atoms per unit area times the work done on each. And the work done on a single atom is the force on that atom times the speed, velocity. As you know, that's the formula for power, force times velocity. And the force on this atom is E naught. And the velocity I call velocity. Now, expanding this square out, that's E naught squared plus 2 alpha E naught EA plus EA squared terms. I disregard EA squared because EA is of order n, and EA squared would be of order n squared. Incidentally, I've also neglected, for the same reason, the energy which is reflected, which is generated in this direction by the source, because the energy carried out here is also of the order EA squared. So, canceling both of these terms, what I need, I get zero, must be this plus this. Now I have to put this in. How much is EA? Well, I have the formula for EA right here. So putting in for the EA, QN over 2 epsilon naught C here times the velocity, apparently got the right sign, I get this term. Because now I have the EA is proportional to the velocity, and the average then is E naught times the velocity. But that's just exactly how much work is being done. And so, in order for this to check out, the alpha must be epsilon naught C. And then it doesn't depend upon how many charges there are or what their charge are, naturally, because the formula for the energy and electric field must be independent of how I tested it. So I know alpha is epsilon naught C, and we have a final formula then that the intensity, which is the energy carried per unit area per second by a beam of electromagnetic waves, is E naught C times the mean square electric field, which is something I wanted to derive to use next time. But now I have one more matter which has been left over from before, which has to be discussed. And well, I'll leave this here in case you want to see what that was all about. And I'll do this here. Last time, we made the statement that the field, that when you have an opaque screen and you have the light can come through some holes in an opaque screen, that the distribution of intensity, the diffraction pattern, could be obtained by imagining instead that the place where the holes are is replaced by sources uniformly distributed, uniform oscillators over the hole. In other words, that the distribution is the same as if the hole was a new source. And we have to explain the reason for that, because the hole, as a matter of fact, is just where there are no sources, where there are no accelerating charges. So I consider first, well, I consider a screen. But let me just remind you about something. What is an opaque screen? Suppose I have a complete opaque screen here. An opaque screen. And I have here a source, S. And there's no field here. Why is there no field there? According to the principles, we should obtain the field that's here, delayed, plus the field from all the other matter. But in the opaque screen, due to the field, due to this, there are motions. And these motions generate a new field which exactly balances this. Say, what a miracle that it exactly balances. Suppose it wasn't exactly right. If it weren't exactly right, remember that this opaque screen is thick, yeah? If it weren't exactly right, the field back here wouldn't be exactly zero. It wouldn't balance out. And so, not being zero, it would drive the material in the screen. A and thus make a little more field trying to get it balanced out. And so if I make the thing thick enough, there's no residual. It has every opportunity to finally get the darn thing quieted down. And if it isn't quite quiet, it shakes a little bit more, which makes a little more fear, which dies out, so that the thing dies out exponentially with thickness. And of course, a thin enough sheet of the most opaque material, even gold, if thin enough, is partially transparent. However, we have an opaque screen. Now, the point is that all the field from infinity, say, impinging on the opaque screen, makes a oscillation which balances it out exactly. Now I want you to consider a screen which has holes in it. Here are some holes. It's also an opaque screen. I draw the source at a finite distance. Well, it doesn't make any difference. The principle is true no matter where the source is. Here's an opaque screen. And I call the screen, these parts where the screen exists, walls. Then what is the field back here? There's two pictures here. There are two different pictures. What is the field back here that we should get through the holes? Answer. The field back there can be represented as a sum of two parts, the field due to the source plus the field due to the walls, due to the motion of the atoms in the walls. Well, it's complicated. We don't know what it is, but that's what the formula is. The total field here is a sum from all sources, the actual source plus the walls. Now, interesting case comes in this way. Suppose that I were to take the same screen but plug up the holes. So that I imagine that in these two areas here, I put plugs of the same material as the wall, exactly. And I call these the holes, although they're really not, they're plugs. Well, let me call them plugs just for fun. But mind you, the plugs go where the holes were in that case. Now let's calculate the field over here. Field over here, which is zero, is equal to the field from the source plus the field due to all the motion of the atoms in these places, which I call the walls, plus the field generated by the motion of the charges in the plugs. But they all balance to naught. Now there's an error. I assumed that the fields in the walls here was exactly the same as the fields in the walls here. Let's call the fields in the walls in this problem E prime, and the fields in the walls in this problem E. They're not exactly the same, because the motion of charges on this plug produces some influence on the walls that's not the same here, so that these two are not precisely the same. But let's see what happens. Now, if I subtract these two equations from each other, I wish I had enough space to do that. If I subtract these two equations from each other, I obtain the following result. Subtracting from this one, I find that the actual field is equal to the field from the plugs plus the E of the walls, which way? I subtracted the wrong way, is minus the field from the plugs minus the field from the walls minus the field from the walls prime. And therefore, the field that's behind the actual screen here can be imagined to be, to a large extent, the field that would be generated by plugs placed in the holes, which is simply a uniform, since in this problem it's so simple, it's just a uniform motion of charges, sheets of charge moving, which is just the way we calculated. What we calculated then for the holes would be correspond to sources just where the plugs are. And that's the correct answer if we disregard this. It turns out that in practice, this is often, almost always, extremely small, and that the error due to disregarding of it is relatively small. Therefore, this law is an approximately satisfactory law. And that's the reason that it works. It's rather an amazing backwards-forwards argument, but it's true. The one case that I would remind you where it does not work well is this. The fields from the walls and the walls prime, naturally, do not differ far from the holes. Because as soon as you get far from the hole, the influence of the plug here is negligible, so that the field here is about the same as here, the motions are about the same. So that this difference is all at the edges of the holes, this difference. And located in a relatively small distance from the edges of the hole. So if the holes are several wavelengths wide, it's a very small term, this this term compared to this, because this is several wavelengths strong and this is relatively weak. But if the holes are smaller than a wavelength, which is sometimes used, say, in radio, when you have a cavity with waves going through a plate, going through a plate, and in the plate there's a small hole smaller than the wavelength, then the contribution from the walls is not any longer small compared to the contribution from the error here is not small compared to, and you get quite the wrong answer for the amount of field that'll penetrate a tiny hole, and this is just one place where the thing doesn't work. But as long as the holes are big enough, this is an excellent approximation to take this term, and that's the basis of the theory of diffraction. Thank you. The main thing is not all the complications, but just the principles to understand that the motion of charges induced by another field is what makes the phenomena of refraction and absorption. So that's all. That's all.
You've adequately explained why it goes slower in the material, but why
faster?
Does it bend?
Well, I didn't adequately explain that, but I started to explain that. However, a more adequate explanation is the following. Well, we don't need this. Suppose that there is a source that's far away at an angle to the surface, some from here. Then the inducing, you see, the field that I said that was inducing the motion was all the same all across the plane. But in fact, in this case, the field here and here and here and here have relative phase. So, for instance, this is plus, minus, and this sort of waves run along. For instance, if I draw a line through the max, through the crest, it looks like this. Now, the field which is generated here by the motions must have that same property. That is, because the fields which started the whole thing have this periodicity, that all the reactions have the same. The fields generated by the motions of the matter also are in and out of phase in the same order. And so, what has to be, the new field that's generated has to have this property that although its wavelength is shorter, as we've just explained, it has to fit so that the maxima and minima of the waves agree with the maxima and minima of the other ones at the surface. In other words, the wave has to find a direction such that if I cut it this way, the spacing between maxima is the same as the spacing between maxima out here. And that's what I was trying to draw, but it went too quick. And if you figure that out, that's the right angle because, let's see, the wavelength in here is lambda vacuum. And the wavelength in here is lambda in the material, say, which is, say, just for a minute, leave it that way. Now I got so many angles, I don't know what to do. But suppose the ray is going this way, and we call this angle theta in. And if I chase my triangle about, this is theta in, so that's the complement of theta in. So this is theta in. Let's see if that checks. When theta in is zero, that's zero, that's right. That's theta in, so is this. And therefore the space from here to here, this spacing here, is lambda naught over the sine of theta n. Well, if you believe me, and the same thing happens over here, that's lambda in the other material over the sine of theta out. But the lambda in the other material is lambda naught over the index, and so you get the formula. Because then, you see, if it did that, the maxima of the oscillations wouldn't appear to coincide. What happens, what has to have happen in all the motions that are inside the material must have their wavelength in this direction, the same as outside. That is, whatever wave you draw inside here has to have the property, when it's all finished, that if I draw a vertical line and I ask for how the objects are moving in there, the object here is moving with a plus motion, here with minus motion, here with a plus motion, in exactly the way that it's been generated by the incoming wave. And in the incoming wave, these plus and minus motions are separated by this distance. Therefore, the plus and minus motions inside must again be separated by that distance. If you want the very simplest picture that most people say, which is essentially right, but is not quite so, this is trying to explain it from a point of view of the new waves that are generated by the motion of the matter, but what people usually say is simple idea is this. If this is a wave front, and if it moves forward to here in a certain amount of time, inside, this point moves out, smaller distance than that because the speed is lower, but here it hasn't gotten in there yet, so it hasn't moved out at all. And so you see this must go through this way. Well, this is still nearly, that doesn't make any difference. That's almost tangent there. That's almost the same for small distance. It does really move to here, if you want, yes. But it moves in such a distance that it moves. No, it must move perpendicular to the fronts, I'm sorry. Yeah, because once you're in the interior, way deep inside, it doesn't know how the damn thing got started. And from then on, it's just propagating a wave, although it doesn't know which is the original directions. It must always propagate a wave whose wavelength is equal to the wavelength in vacuum over n. And so it does. But it has to find an angle so that this periodicity is the same as the one in the source outside.
Suppose it were propagating in this direction.
Yeah.
So
this is the way it's propagating.
Yeah. Well, why couldn't it propagate that way? With a
shorter wavelength? All right.
Or a
no, it can have a different wavelength. Because if you have a certain frequency, certainly the atoms everywhere, they're driven up and down, ding, ding, ding. So the frequency must be the same in here as outside. So the atoms are responding at a certain frequency. And when they respond at a certain frequency, they produce waves, scattered waves of a certain size and so on, and they add to the original wave in such a manner that that wave will move with this wavelength, with a given frequency, and there's nothing you can do about that, you see?
So it has to move.
Yeah, so the only, and in addition to that feature, in the case when you have an angular input, you have this peculiar necessity that the spacing here must match with this. The same thing, incidentally, works going out of the other side of the glass. The space these waves have this way. And so they're generating, they're like a bunch of sources, which is oscillating up and down, just like a diffraction grating with a certain spacing. And the new wave that's generated coming out from this diffraction grating has to be in a direction so that for the speed here, the timing is just right, you know, just like we did before. And so it determines a new angle at which it comes out. But you remember also that we said that when a diffraction grating has too small a spacing, less than the wavelength of the light in vacuum, it won't radiate any direction.
See, if it's plus and minuses here, and they were too close together, there's no solution to the problem. So if the light is inside the material moving at a very highly inclined angle and has a short wavelength, so that this is plus and minus, plus and minus, plus and minus, and that the wavelength in the air that this stuff should have is, say, this big. There's no angle at which you can come out where this distance is a wavelength, because this is too short. And therefore, it can't get out at all. And this is known, this what actually happens is a new wave starts back inside. I mean, this thing bounces off here, and a new wave starts going this way. It's reflected, but it's not, doesn't go into the other medium. So, and so on and so on. But we haven't got time, I didn't want to add too many things to the complicated thing we already have.
One thing about your symbolism, you have E is equal to the bunny end Q over 2 epsilon C velocity. Is that the retardance Z?
Yeah.
What is the significance of that?
I mean, just what it means over here. That it's retarded by this distance Z from here, not from some other distance. That's all I meant. I meant retarded by Z would be better than 2. That's better, by Z. By Z over C. That would be the right way to write it, yeah. Retarded by Z over C. That it would have been clear. Yeah, yeah, you're quite right. That was written badly. Yeah. Yes. Right. Which, what I said here?
Yeah.
Yes. No, it was supposing that the points are very far away compared to the size of the gradient. That's right. If it isn't true, then you have then you have to make a calculation. The timings are not linear, you know what I mean? They're not proportional. They're not the same anymore, and that's much more complicated. And that's what that damn Cornu spiral was for adding things in which the phase goes as a square, because the next approximation is that as you turn up, it goes as a square. First it's linear, and then it's quadratic. And Cornu spiral is for a quadratic phase. So it's more complicated, yes. We've only done the simple example where we're way out in infinity. The only case that we did at a finite distance is this one over here. But I picked the problem which I could do the integral always. We always have to do that, or we get, you know, in the beginning. The only complications of other, more what they call advanced, is it the same thing, except you'll find a harder integral, that's all. And in this problem, it turns out, because I have to go all the way around 2 pi rho and so on, I could do some finagling around here, and it turned out to be an easy integral. But in general, it isn't so easy. For instance, if you wanted to know what the field would be from a line of charge, all oscillating up and down nearby, and you tried to do the integral, you'd find it very difficult. If n is complex, which it is, suppose we write it as the sum of 2, a real piece, minus I times another real thing. This is real. That's right. Real, real. Oh, I'm sorry. No. We didn't use primes for derivatives, but no, I'm sorry. I just meant the real and the imaginary piece. And I noted that the imaginary was negative, and in order to make it clear, I put minus in there. I'm sorry. Yes, sir. I sawed it with a saw.